teachings are kept. It's the Pali word that has been translated as mindfulness. And it's just a horrible translation. But it's a, the reason I want to talk about sati is because of all the things the Buddha brought to the table, sati was one of them. He didn't bring the concentration practices to the party. When he left home, he went and spent time with a couple of concentration masters and mastered those skills quickly to the point where each of them offered him co-leadership of their sangha. But he said, yeah, but the problem is when you open your eyes, it's same old, same old. So he spent 5 years, 6 years investigating his experience. And he brought this meditation practice, which sati. So why do we translate it as mindfulness? Well, so some hundreds of years ago, four or five, and the Christian missionaries were expanding into India, and they encountered all these people in these orange robes, and they tried to make sense of what they saw, and they said, oh, look just like monks and nuns. Because we got monks and nuns, that's what they look like. Of course, the word for them in their language was bhikkhu and bhikkhuni, which means beggar. So not so much monks and nuns. And then they looked at the places where they lived and they said, oh, well, for monks and monasteries. Right? But actually for the people there, the word was vihara and it just meant the place to live. Monastery is a place to go and be alone, monastery. So they sort of, and what do we got? We got monks and nuns and we've got monasteries. That happened in a whole lot of other areas. Metta, for example, the word metta, translated as loving kindness, that's how we know it, isn't it? Not how we talk about it? That's because they thought that was the spiritual sentiment, that's what Jesus would have wanted, and so that must be what the Buddha meant. But the word metta actually is a direct derivative of the Sanskrit word mitta, which just means friend. So we're talking about friendliness. Not the same. It's easier to be friendly than to love someone who's not so lovable. Although, what do I know? So sati is a word that comes from a Sanskrit word that doesn't have any vowels, so it's hard to pronounce. Smriti, something like that, which means to remember, to recall. You know, there's a sense in Western Dharma circles that mindfulness practice is somehow some kind of non-conceptual awareness, non-conceptual practice. There's no mention of non-conceptual practice in the early texts. And if you listen to the instructions that the Buddha gave for the meditation practice, he says, breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. I know I'm breathing in. Right. So there's always a knowing. There's always a knowing present in our being. The way the Buddha, he recognized that the mind is always trying to identify what's going on. If it doesn't have a clue, it always, you know, this is a room full of things, right? The brain identifies its environment. The other thing that is often missed, there's another word in the Pali, which is manasikara, which means just attention. So mindfulness is not just attention, although it is attention to experience, but it's not just attention. Attention is focused. Sati is spacious. It locates the experience in the whole field of our awareness. and it always contains metta. Because there's always going to be an intention present, always in your experience. And if that intention is centered on a self, on coming up with wanting or not wanting, greed, hatred, or delusion, well, it's kind of hard to be mindful because you're wanting, not paying attention. You know what I mean? So metta is it's caring. So sati, and I'll just use the term mindfulness. Mindfulness is a caring attention. In the Abhidhamma, which is after the Buddha died, for a couple hundred years, people were trying to figure out what he just said. And they came up with categories and books and stuff that are just horribly tedious. Stay away. And it's easy because most of them are so bad they haven't been translated. But in the outlines of the Abhidhamma, it's clear that when mindfulness is present, all the beautiful factors are present. Equanimity, friendliness, joy, conscience is present. So sati is important. It's not just non-conceptual awareness. There are actually four kinds of mindfulness in the early texts. So I'm going to talk about the kinds of mindfulness in the early texts, then I'm going to talk about satipatthana, which is the word that refers to the cultivation of sati, learning how to pay attention. And then I'll talk a little bit about samasati, right mindfulness, which is as mindfulness occurs in the Eightfold Path. Okay, so that's where we're going. So there are four types of mindfulness in the early texts, and the first one is the one we all pretty much know. It's simple awareness. It's just straight registering the data that's coming in at the sense doors. There's a story in one of the early texts, a guy named Bahia of the bark cloth. I think that means he was wearing bark. Bahia of the bark cloth, he heard the Buddha was in town. He was a practitioner, he was a samana. He lived in the woods. And he heard the Buddha was in town, so he went to He went to the Buddha and he said something on the order of, "What's up?" And, you know, "What's the story? Tell me your." And the Buddha said, "I'm on alms rounds. Please come back after lunch." And Bahia said, "Well, you know, I know enough about impermanence to know there may be no after lunch. So what can you tell me now?" So the Buddha gave him the shortest Dharma talk you've ever heard, which was, "In the seeing, only the seeing. In the hearing, only the hearing. In the touching, in the tasting, in the smelling, and in the cognizing, in the knowing, only the knowing." So the raw data of our experience comes in through the five sense gates and the mind. What is in your mind is the Buddha considers a sixth sense. The mind perceives things. We look at this and we see a bell. People who've had their eyesight restored after surgery don't see things. They are very disturbed usually because if they've eyesight has been gone for a while, they don't have the neural networks to make sense of these colors. So we don't even recognize the role that the mind plays in constructing our reality. You know, a third of your brain is devoted to interpreting visual material. That's a healthy hunk. Anyway, that basic data is the foundation of registering the data. What happens is the basic foundation for all forms of sati. Just knowing what's happening at those sense gates. And that's why we do our practice. There are practices that we start with the breathing, and that is there's a whole sutta that's devoted just to mindfulness of breathing. There's one to mindfulness of the body, and some of you have done body scans. We do walking meditation where we pay attention to the sensations on the soles of the feet. We're paying attention to the sensations of the body. We're paying attention to our subjective experience. But often that's where we get off. Everybody sort of thinks that's sort of meditation. There's some interesting, there's a second kind of mindfulness. I'll read this little, this is out of one of the early texts. Call it protective awareness. And it's interesting because it clearly shows that mindfulness is not just paying attention to physical sensations. The Buddha says, and how, bhikkhus, has a bhikkhu comprehended a mode of conduct, a manner of dwelling in such a way that as he conducts himself thus and as he dwells thus, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and displeasure do not flow in on him? So how does he live so that this stuff, desire and aversion, anger and hatred, not flow in him? He says, suppose a man would enter a thorny forest. There would be thorns in front of him, thorns behind him, thorns to his left, thorns to his right, thorns above and thorns below. He would go forward mindfully. He would go back mindfully, thinking, may no thorn stick me. So too, bhikkhus, whatever in the world has a pleasing and agreeable nature is called a thorn in the noble one's discipline. Having understood this, one should understand restraint and non-restraint. He's saying the pleasantries of the world lead us to desire and aversion, pleasantness and unpleasantness in our experience. And it's an important thing. We're gonna deal with vedana, with feeling tone, because these are neurons. So in your brain, the neurology that sets up like and don't like is embedded, more neurons, in the neurology of want, don't want. So if you like, you want. If you don't like, you don't want. It's automatic. There are no neurons going in here to perceive that. It's just these neurons light up and these light up. So paying attention to the feeling tone is really important. And we'll see how that works out when we get to the cultivation of sati. And he says, you know, wanting and not wanting, those are our polarities, and they go with pleasant and unpleasant. There's another one here. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. He says, just as a royal frontier fortress has a gatekeeper, wise, experienced, intelligent, to keep out those he doesn't know. We got knowing in there again. And to let in those that he does, for the protection of those within and to ward off those without. In the same way, a disciple of the noble ones is mindful, highly meticulous, remembering and able to call to mind even things that were done and said a long time ago. With mindfulness as his gatekeeper, the disciple of the noble ones abandons what is unskillful, develops what is skillful, abandons what is blameworthy, develops what is blameless, and looks after himself with purity. He's setting up a pretty high standard here for this meditation that we just did. You know what I mean? Protective awareness, it's a huge part, and it means that you are not just looking to see colors and shapes and to feel physical sensations. You want to know whether what you're experiencing is for the benefit of yourself and others or not. So recognizing kusala and akusala, wholesomeness and unwholesome. I hate those words. They but I'm not quite sure what to replace them with. The Pali is kusala and akusala, skillful and unskillful. There's a third kind of meditation, or third kind of mindfulness, that the Buddha identified, that we think of as introspective awareness. Not just looking out and seeing colors and shapes and listening to sounds, because we can do meditation on sounds, you know, but to look inward and to observe the intentional stream, the emotional stream, what's going on in us moment to moment. Usually we just float along with it, but if we can maintain some stability with our attention, we can keep, so it's like this kind of practice, like keeping one hand on a railing on a steep stairway. Help keep your balance, just keep yourself steady, not get lost in thought dreams. When you're lost in thought dreams, my wife calls that la-la land. When you're not in la-la land, you can pay attention to what's going on, but we get lost pretty easily. And that's why coming back again and again is the thing. So we want to pay attention to wanting and not wanting, particularly. The fourth kind of mindfulness I don't hear it talked about much at all. Tell me if you've deliberately forming concepts. No? It's a kind of practice where you intentionally bring to mind a particular object, a mind object, a thought, a memory, something. You can see it. You've heard it.
Recollections.
Right.
Recollecting.
Sure, sure. That's certainly kind. The Buddha teaches in the foundation, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha also there's a meditation practice where he has you contemplate the parts of the body, but parts of the body that you can't see, like the spleen and the lungs and the liver and the blood and the, you know. How are you doing that? You know, the idea, he says, is to try to cultivate some dispassion about the body, because we take the body personally. We think it's ours. And if it were ours, we'd have better control over it than we do. I mean, really. Our bodies have a mind of their own. But he has three different kinds of recollections. There are the negative ones, the ideas when, you know, to cultivate dispassion. There are positive recollections. So he tells you to remember the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Sometimes he tells you to remember devas, you know, their equivalent of angels, and you know. And then this I've got to read this because this is really fun. I came across this a little while ago. His cousin's name is Anuruddha. He said, "So Anuruddha, it's not for the purpose of scheming to deceive people, or for the purpose of flattering people, or for the purpose of gain, honor, and renown for me, or even with the thought, let people know that I am someone who thinks this. It's not for those purposes that when a disciple has died, the Tathagata," this is how the word he used to refer to himself, "that when a disciple has died, the Tathagata declares where he has been reborn. So-and-so has been reborn here, so-and-so else has been reborn there." He says it's not for the purpose of deceiving, which I think is interesting. He says, "Rather, it's because there are faithful clansmen inspired and gladdened by what is lofty, who, when they hear such talk, direct their minds to higher states and that leads to their welfare and happiness for a long time. So he's saying, you know, I even talk about this rebirth stuff for the purpose of elevating consciousness. And then there's metta, all the metta practices where you conjure images of a neutral person and try to evoke sentiment in regard to them, or even metta was originally taught, I believe, as a mindfulness practice, not as a concentration practice, not as a repetition practice. So, for example, you would imagine someone, bring some person to mind, and then try to evoke friendliness towards them and watch what happens. Because you can imagine, well, if you want to even particularly noticeable if you translate it as loving kindness, imagine trying to cultivate mindfulness for, you know, he who should not be named. What comes up? What a rich field to study. All that stuff that comes up. You know, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Watch how that comes up in yourself. What a great way. Introspective awareness through intentionally forming concepts. So, these are the four kinds of mindfulness that we want to practice. And the way we cultivate mindfulness is not the same way that we use it. I think of it as sort of like practicing finger exercises for music in order to play music. The scales are not the music, but you got to do the scales or you're not going to be able to do so. Mindfulness practice is not trying to get better and better at following your breath. Although, getting better and better at following your breath and keeping track of the sensations there helps your ability to pay attention to all data that's coming in. Okay. So we want to cultivate mindfulness in order to use it in our walking around world. So the word satipatthana, sati and patthana, foundation, the foundations of mindfulness, there are four of them. And some of you are going to be familiar with these, have been over it again and again. The first one would be, and they track, for those of you who know this, I'm not going to get into it, but they track the skandhas. So the first one is mindfulness of the body, rupa. The first foundation is mindfulness of the body, and the first exercise is mindfulness of breathing. And then you get mindfulness of posture, mindfulness of movement, mindfulness of, mindfulness of the internal organs. And there are these wonderful charnel ground meditations where he encouraged his followers to spend time practicing around the decaying and burning corpses to help cultivate dispassion toward the body and to reduce the grasping, the clinging to it. And there are a lot of these of practices like this. The breathing is one. I'll just give you, I may have described some of these before. I'll just do quickly. One of the things that I developed in the prison was what we call the three breath trip. And so the three breath trip is just paying attention to three breaths in a row. Don't change your posture. Don't close your eyes. You don't need to do anything. But pay attention to three breaths in a row. Let's do that right now. Just pay attention to the sensation of the next three breaths, paying particular attention to the ending of the out-breath, particularly the third. So let's do three, the next three breaths and watch what happens. So you can do that as many times a day as you want. I was working with a guy who was in so much pain that he couldn't sit still, which is why I suggested that he do that. I said, do three, and try to do three, four times a day. Try to just get a beginning. I came back the next week. I said, how are you doing? He said, I'm doing it 50 or 60 times a day. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I watch a lot of TV, and every time there's a commercial break, I take the three breath trip. And this, you know, you think that, you think you need long retreat practice and all. So I worked with him for about 6 weeks. He was a guy who told me when I first met him that nobody messed with him because he would maul them. And then they would leave him alone. And about after a couple months, he told me stories about how do you pass the knife to the guy during a basketball game just before you go stab him. And I came in and asked him how he was. He said, you know, on my way over, I was watching some guys rat pack another guy. It's where they stand around and kick you until you die or the guards save you. And he said, I used to root those guys on, but this time it seemed a little sad. And I thought, wow. So it doesn't take a lot. Learn to pay attention in a different way, and you see different things. Let me show you one other. I mean, you can do, let's do this one. Let's do mindfulness of listening. We'll do this for just, I don't know, 10 seconds. Just listen to the sounds that are present the way you would listen to rain on a roof or wind in the trees. It's a physical sensation, rupa, mindfulness of body. There are meditation practices, mindfulness of color mandalas and stuff, mindfulness of sound. There's a bunch of physical ones. Learning to pay attention to the body is important. The second one, the second foundation is actually, it's my favorite. It's mindfulness of Vedana, feeling tone, pleasant and unpleasant. And the language in the text is just really short. It's like, knows a pleasant feeling as a pleasant feeling and knows an unpleasant feeling as an unpleasant feeling. Now, the first foundation is pages and pages of description. This is like this much, 10 lines, 20 lines, something like that. And we tend to write it off. But there's a practice, I may have mentioned this. Have I talked about the Vedana meter to you guys before? Looks like not. Good. So paying attention to pleasant and unpleasant is huge because what we like, we want. What we don't like, we don't want. Monitoring our intentions is aided immensely by being able to monitor the feeling tone of what's going on. So when you go to the doc and the doc says, on a scale of 0 to 10, how's your pain? You can do that? Not so hard. But you can also do it positively. So on a scale of 0 to 10, where's vanilla ice cream? Really, measure it. Can you come up with a number? Yeah. So let me ask about Brussels sprouts. Yeah, that's you. A ten is usually means there's a circuit that's shorted. Yeah, because 10 means there isn't anything there. So if you're telling me there's nothing in your experience that's more pleasureful than Brussels sprouts? Well, maybe. Even a little bit more pleasure and you'd be unconscious. Okay. Boy, you'd be easy to cook for. So you can put those two scales together, minus 10 being the worst, more pain than that, unconsciousness. More, ecstasy than that, you minus 10 to plus 10, zero as neutral, so you can see how much of this spectrum is neutral. And calibrate this scale using that fourth foundation, that fourth kind of mindfulness. So for me, rubbing my dog is like a 7.5 or an 8. You can measure anything that you bring, that you put your mind's focus on. How do you feel at this moment? I've got a cold. I'm feeling a little minus-y there. Maybe a 2. This isn't agony. But, it's just sort of off. What about cute animal videos? Measure. Just try this a little bit. How about our previous president? Come up with a number? How about our current president? We can come up with a number. How about getting a blood test? It's not a minus 8. How about, you can imagine things, bring things to mind. Swimming on a warm day. Cleaning up after dinner. See how the range of pleasant, unpleasant, it's huge. It's there all the time. It's a constant part of our experience. Every experience has a feeling tone. Often it hovers so close to the midpoint that we just don't notice. And often we don't notice it because we're focused on the object of attention and we're not liking them or liking them. So we aren't even noticing. It's where the third foundation comes in. Third foundation is often referred to as mind states. We can use the Vedana meter. Actually, it's a multi-purpose tool. And because it's a mental app, you can make it any, you can make it neon lights or an old gauge or anything you want. But the third foundation is about noticing when greed is present and when it's not present. The word in Pali is lobha, and that means not just greed, it means the whole range of wanting. From wanting, desire, lusting, craving, wishing, it's a whole spectrum. Having a preference, it's a spectrum of wanting. Knowing when lobha is present and when it's not present. Knowing when aversion, and the word is dosa, which means ill will, anger, hatred, it's rage, loathing, any of that negative stuff. Know when that's present and when it's not. And then the tricky one, which is delusion. Noticing when delusion is present and when delusion is absent, which is tricky. How do you know when you're deluded? And I would just suggest that if you think you're not, really, if you think, it's like one of these, if you think you're not, tell me what's going on. I mean, really, what's going on? How did this happen? Here we are. Anybody have a clue? We show up. I didn't decide to be here. I just showed up in this package, got a mind of its own. I can't do anything about it. I can't do anything about hardly anything. What is going on? And yet, we think we know what's going on. We have ideas, and we'll argue over them. Right? It's not just me. I know. So delusion. Somebody asked Ajahn Pasano, who's a monk up at Abhayagiri, how would you know when you're deluded? And he said, because you're suffering. You'll be suffering. And that sounded like a reasonable thing, except that I then thought, well, most people are suffering a whole lot more than they notice. How do you know when you're suffering? I think that it's sort of like, you know, when the refrigerator goes off in the other room and all of a sudden it's quiet and you didn't realize that it was on. Or the air conditioner goes off. I think dukkha is like that. Dissatisfaction, suffering is like that. It's ambient. It's always present. And why? I think at the deepest level, because we know this life experience is transitory. It's ephemeral. And we're not built to like ephemeral. We're built to like security and stability and safety. So I think underlying all of this, there's this unease. How do you notice that? I think a marker for delusion is complaint. If you have a complaint, whether it's justified or not, it's a direct expression of dissatisfaction. And you can add dissatisfaction into the unpleasantness of whatever you're dissatisfied about, and you get that really potent, toxic brew of dukkha. You know, it maps completely with the Four Noble Truths. The first truth, such is complaint. The second truth, such the origin of complaint. What causes us to complain? There's all these things to complain about, but not everybody complains about the same thing. Complaint is in us. Complaint comes from us. Third truth, we don't have to complain. There is a possibility of a complaint-free life. That doesn't mean that we necessarily accept everything that comes, but we engage it fully without complaint, with an effort to at least not make things worse. And then the fourth truth would be the way of living a complaint-free life, which would be the Eightfold Path. I'll talk about that when we get to Samasati. Oh, we better move right along. So you can use the Vedana meter to measure the intensity. So that's delusion. It's dukkha, complaint. Figure out how to live a complaint-free life, a life free of complaining. Imagine what that would be. How blissful, even if there's pain in it. Even if there's discomfort in it. The fourth foundation is off. Oh, I got it. The Vedana meter. So, to use the Vedana meter, you want to bring up these intentions, greed, hatred, and delusion. That's the way they're referred to in shorthand. And so, you can measure. Use this meter to measure how much do I want that Tesla. How much do I want those Brussels sprouts? How much do I not want? Oh God! You know, we're just really wrecked. You know, what comes to my mind is a second term. I'm sorry. How much do we not want this? How much do we not want that? And measuring that changes your relationship. How angry am I at this person? It changes your relationship to it changes the whole experience. If the object of your experience is this, you're mad at this person, that's the focus of your attention and all the stuff is going on. If you become mindful, if you make the anger itself the object of your attention, that's very different than having the object of your attention be the object of anger. You can study the anger and see what it feels like. Where do you feel it in the body? But also notice it's not the same thing as noticing just the simple physical stuff like tension in the chest, tension in the jaw, stories about I'm right and they're wrong. That's always going on there with anger. So, you know, it's not just watching the sense data, it's also recognizing the anger. So measure that. It's like measuring pain. I've also noticed that when you get up around a 7 or an 8, certainly with pain, mindfulness is not so helpful. You know, and if you get up to a 7 or an 8 with desire, you guys remember the Newton? Yeah, I didn't think so. Yeah, that's sort of the point. Newton. Like, no, like an apple Newton. So this was 25 years ago, or probably a little more. Apple came up with this device that was the first PDA, personal digital assistant. It was big, it was supposed to recognize your handwriting, and it had your calendar, all the stuff this was their first, and I wanted it. Even though it was $800. So as I walked across the floor of the Moscone Center to buy my Newton, which these days lives in a shelf in the closet, you can't throw away a Newton. I was measuring, this is wanting at a level of 8, 8.5. I was, you know, this is what it's like. All you can do is be mindful and notice. Notice the feeling tone. So use the Vedana meter to measure the intensity of some of these experiences. It helps bring mindful attention. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of dhammas, mindfulness of mind objects, the things we think about. What things should we think about? What things should we bring our attention to? This is out of the fourth kind of mindfulness, intentionally creating concepts. Well, there are four different sets of the early texts. The earliest texts are a bookshelf about this long. I mean, the Buddha taught for 45 years. Jesus got a chance to teach for what, 2 or 3? And nobody wrote anything down for quite a while. Well, these people were remembering. That's what they did because they didn't trust writing. So they were memorizing. So we've got this canon of remembered texts in the Pali, in Chinese, because it went to China too. Little different route. In Tibetan, we have a Tibetan canon and a Sanskrit canon. We can take all four, and match them up and look at what's there. In the Pali canon, the fourth foundation, the Buddha says, pay attention to these five things, the sense bases, right? Pay attention to the sense bases, the skandhas, which I'm not going to go into. The hindrances, which are the experiences which impel us towards suffering. The factors of awakening, which are the experiences and the practices that move us towards liberation, and the four truths. Now, if you go through all the four canons, those five things are not in all of them. So either somebody forgot something or somebody added something in, but something happened. But there are two that are in all of them, and that are the hindrances and the factors of awakening. So the fourth foundation of mindfulness, as I work with it, are about noticing what leads to suffering and what leads to liberation. What is wholesome, what is skillful, and what is not. So these are the four foundations of mindfulness, and satipatthana, as I say, practicing things. One of my early teachers, Ayakema, she used to say, this is practice mindfulness. Practice concentration. Because the real stuff is samasati. Now, if you go online and you look at the Access to Insight website, Tanjeff, and I think most of the monastics will tell you that samasati, which is what we translate as right mindfulness, is the same thing as satipatthana. I think he says it just right there. But I think that's not right. Or maybe let me put it this way. I see it differently. Because I think that fourth noble truth is about a way to live without suffering. So the elements on that, the eight folds, exist on there only to the extent that they enable us to be free from suffering. Right view, the first one, is right understanding, right knowledge, right story, right narrative. If I ask you what's going on, you're going to tell me a story. You're going to express, you're going to describe your perception of things, right perception. Second one would be right intention, and our intention comes from our understanding. Our understanding conditions our intention. And then you get right speech, right action, right livelihood, which get brushed by a lot of people. I think this is the whole point of the practice, to be able to live, to speak, to act, and assemble a life without dukkha, without making things worse for yourself and others, and being able to respond with friendliness and compassion and equanimity to what life presents us with. Right effort, it takes practice. And then samasati and samasamadhi. Samasati is mindfulness that enables us to be free. So it's monitoring. What is it monitoring? You know, it's monitoring our intentions. What sets, and as we monitor that, insight happens. You've had an insight, you know, an insight changes everything. It changes the way you perceive everything. So in this practice, you're sitting along and then you go, oh. You had that happen? If you've just been doing it for 5 minutes, you probably haven't. But with a bit of practice, you start to notice things. First thing, one of the things I point the guys in prison to is that they aren't in control of their thoughts. Most of them never thought about it. Just assume they could. So I say, okay, let's take a minute. Stop your thinking. And then at the end of a minute, how'd it go? And they go, oh my gosh. That's an insight. To realize that the thoughts are just happening on their own. We're not in control. And we think, I'm thinking, right? I think this and I think that. But the thoughts are just happening. Who's doing that thinking? I'll leave you to figure that one out. But the insight changes your understanding, reframes your understanding of how things work and what there is. The Buddha said that when it comes to the Eightfold Path, right view, right understanding is first. For one of right view who sees clearly as he sees things clearly as they are, everything else falls in place. Right intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. For one of delusional view, I think the opposite of right view is not wrong view, it's delusional view. For one of delusional view, everything goes south. So it's insight that frees us. It's not telling ourselves what to do, work harder, try harder, you know. There are a lot of people who say, let go. That's what you have to do. Practice letting go. But that's telling yourself what to do. You think you can do that. If you're holding on like this, and you're going, let go, let go, let go. So mindful recognition would be what? I'm holding on, holding on, holding on. We're missing that when we're telling ourselves to let go. And then if I say, you know, that pen is covered in poison, I'm not going to hold it. What changed? My understanding of what was going on. Reframe. So the idea is that reframing, cultivating right view, that's the business of sati. Cleaning up our perceptions so that we don't think the things, what are the distortions of perception? The Buddha says, seeing impermanent things as permanent. There's nothing permanent. You know? Really? It's all changing. It's radical impermanence. And if in the, and that means us too. You know, you're different than when you walked in that door. And you probably can't remember what you were thinking when you walked in the door. You know? So here we are, we're different. What is there to cling to? Telling yourself not to cling doesn't work. It's just an expression of a desire to be different. And we're not noticing that desire. But if you recognize that everything is so impermanent, what it, including us. Yes, I love my new car, but in 6 weeks the car is pretty much the same. And it's sort of, we're different. We've moved on to wanting something else. We just want machines. The second thing to recognize, the anicca dukkha, the unsatisfactory nature of all experience, because even the stuff that's pleasant is impermanent and will change. What we want, really, is pleasant stuff that stays pleasant. Not pleasant stuff that changes, but everything changes, so everything is unsatisfactory. And also anatta, insubstantial. Not real in a sense. We think, I mean, think about it. If the dinosaurs had thought about it, they probably thought they were real. Right? But they're nowhere to be found. We think this experience, there's realities here. It's just unfolding is all. Nothing permanent, just empty phenomena rolling on. So what we want to see, we want insight. Insight is what frees us. So let me give you a quick example of how that worked for me. I told you I bought a Newton. I've been an Apple bigot for quite some time. And I felt entitled. So I go get my computer fixed, and I even take my computer to Apple to fix it. So, you know, I go into the Apple store, I see the counter at the back, I want to go right back there and say, you told me my computer's ready, you can give it to me. But I meet this young person who's got an iPad in her hand, and she says, can I help you? Yeah, I want to go to the back so I can get my, they said it was ready. Oh, well go, there's a line, there's somebody with an iPad and there's just a line. So I sort of grumbled a little bit, but okay, I went over to the line and I waited in the line and I get up to the line and, what do you do? Oh, you need to go and wait in that line over there. Well, I was not a happy camper. I was really, it's hard to even recall how angry I was, because I got to that other line and I was fuming, and I thought, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to go home. I'll come back later. And then I realized that's going to take way more time. And I totally let go of, and I actually got to watch somebody buy a computer with cash, which I would have not noticed at all. That was pretty good. I mean, how many times do you see that happen? So that was an insight, a reframe of what was going on. You can't tell yourself to let go, but you can remind your, if once you have that insight, you can remind yourself. And you say, oh, this is a time to let go, and then it can happen. So I do an awful lot of driving. I do way too much driving, but I do a lot of driving, and often, you ever get behind somebody who's just going a little too slow? And you're maybe a little late? And you can feel it in your body. It's visceral. It's, well, I spent a long time working on that. Let go, let go. What else? You know, that's what people teach. You know, don't feel this way. You know, relax. None of that worked. And then I somehow associated that experience at the Apple store with this situation. And I said, oh, it's just I'm in a hurry. It was in, you know, it was in the hurry. And as soon as I saw that, it let go. It just released, like dropping the pen. And then I was just moving in slow traffic. And if I was going to be late, well, big deal. You know, I'm not going to stress myself out over what I couldn't control. So you can take an insight and leverage it. This way, remind yourself. Because what we're trying to do is reframe, not to reach some exotic meditative state, you know, or to, we're just trying to see what's going on. When you see what's going on, automatically things will change. So let me take a minute or two here and see if there are questions, complaints. Please.
I'm a little curious about what's going on.
Yeah.
And we get an answer that nothing's going on. How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about nothing?
Which means the person's not, well, my interpretation of what's going on with that person is they're not being mindful.
Yeah, well, not everybody gets to be mindful. It depends on the person. It depends on the context. I don't have a one-size-fits-all response. You know, the first patriarch in the Zen tradition was once asked to sum up the essence of Zen. And his answer was an appropriate response. I mean, if you stop some poor guy on the street and say, you're not being mindful, he's going to call the cops.
No, I was talking about it in the context.
Ah, but
when you're
well, again, it depends on the context. And it depends on how I'm feeling. And it depends on who that person is. You know? Anything else? Yeah?
It's a little off topic, but I've been using the mindfulness of breathing sutta for meditation instructions for myself.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking about it with a friend, and I was telling her how I do it, and she was saying, no, you got it all wrong. This is a description of what will happen when you pay attention to your breath. This is not something that you follow like instructions or mm-hmm. a roadmap. You know, but when I read the sutta, says,
train this way.
Exactly. I shall, that's one translation, but I shall do this, I shall do that.
So I have a couple of things. First of all, the Buddha said, I teach a teaching that does not contend with anyone, that does not dispute with anyone, with gods and maras and men. That is a really powerful concept, because if you're in a situation of contention, whatever it is, it's not the Dharma. I'd also say I studied with a guy, Kinchino Weber. Kinchino. And at one point in one of the time when I was with him, he used the phrase, he said, use any trick in the book to wake up, to see what's going on. You are the one who has to wake up yourself. Nobody can do it for you. So everybody's got their opinion about what's the right way to meditate. You've got a meditation master in Burma who says you've got to master all eight jhanas before you can even begin Vipassana meditation. I had his senior disciple. She said to me, oh, you can't be doing Vipassana meditation. You haven't mastered the jhanas. And then you've got senior Burmese meditation masters who say, choiceless awareness, that's the way to go. Well, which is right? So the trick is for you to find the fruitful path. How do you know the difference? I guess this was with the talk I did on the refuges, you know, the Sangha. How do you recognize the difference between a fruitful path and a dry hole? You're the only one that can do that for yourself. So listen to what she says, take it under advisement, think about, and you know, you're the one that does it. Go for it. Is that helpful? Anybody else? Everybody's good. Well, thank you for your attention. Go forth and cling no more.